Rated that, particularly these, I was placed in group homes. Two of the five group homes that I was placed in eventually ended up getting shut down by the state for abusing children and the abuses that would happen in them places. School, I got in trouble in school and they suspended, you know, they kicked me out and my outburst. And as a kid, I was actually quiet. To this day, I'm actually an introvert. People don't believe that, but I was actually a quiet. And then after the death of my mom, I started having these emotional outbursts that got treated as a behavioral issue, that got punished. So I was punished all the way. I was punished with double life without, triple 23. Like, they didn't help. The system didn't help. And then when I refused to let my spirit be broken, they threw me in solitary confinement. The people that invested in me was volunteers. The programs that helped me the most, that gave me, you know, education was so important because with new information, I could have new ideas. And with new ideas, I could reimagine what was possible for me in the world. So whereas I might have once idolized Al Capone, I was now looking at Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Viktor Frankl. And that all came through education. And these put me in the hole for having books that weren't mine. Right? And I'm the outlier. Just because I come home and I'm working on my emotional growth and my spiritual well-being and giving back, you know, I had to fight for the opportunities that I got. And the people that invested in me and helped in me, they are often barred or discouraged. And so I have seen the system. You know, I did 28 years inside, so I've seen different administrations and different cultural environments and stuff, different atmospheres. And I came home a little over 3 years ago, and when I was leaving, there was starting to be a shift. But for the most part, it was, you know, you get sentenced, you get thrown beyond the wall, you follow the rules, otherwise you get punished, and that was it. It was people that cared, that invested love in education, and that's what changed me, and that's how I got to a point to where I am now. So
you have been listening to excerpts from the Oregon Criminal Justice 2025 Summit. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, and thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.
As part of the All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, Comics Take co-host comedian Kimberly Nickel is producing a stand-up comedy show celebrating Women's History Month with a full cast of Not Dude comedians, sharing their best PG-13 rated jokes. The show will be live for an audience on Friday, March 28th at 6:30 p.m. Set your intentions, save your seat, RSVP at kboo.fm/comedy. KBOO Studio will be filled with an audience enjoying puns, impressions, and cocktails. It'll be better with you there. Join us in the back of KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland on Friday, March 28th, 6:30 p.m. This event will be recorded and played on the radio waves on Monday, March 31st at 10 p.m. Donations to KBOO are encouraged. If you don't show up on the 28th, no one will hear your laughter on the 31st.
Phil, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcasts and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagie land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, we're sharing an interview with two contributors to an amazing history of anti-racist organizing in the late 1980s through the mid-1990s in Portland, Oregon, and with ripples across the so-called USA and beyond. In 2020, KBOO Radio released a serialized podcast called It Did Happen Here. So the KBOO podcast tells the story of Portland that I'll try to give a brief rundown of here, but I really suggest giving the podcast a listen. In the story, Portland is facing an increasingly bold white supremacist skinhead scene in 1988. Members of a bonehead crew known as East Side White Pride shock the city by murdering Ethiopian immigrant and father Mulugeta Sarah as he attempts to break up a fight. And this is a part of a wider push by white supremacist organizers, names such as David Duke and Tom Metzger might come to mind. Across Portland, immigrants, anti-racists, activists in the black communities, gay and lesbian activists from ACT UP, veterans of the New Left, punks, pastors, congregations, members of marginalized communities and their allies step up to push the growing Nazi threat out of their scenes, neighborhoods, and city. Simultaneously, a multiracial crew of skinheads against racial prejudice in the Twin Cities, Minnesota, known as the Minneapolis Baldies, have been fighting the KKK in their city and surrounding areas. The Baldies have reached out to anti-racist skinheads in Chicago's group Skinheads of Chicago, or SHOCK, who have been fighting a similar fight, as well as to other skins and punks in the region to create a network called the Syndicate, later branching out to create the Anti-Racist Action Network, which eventually became ARA. While the white nationalists attempted to infiltrate and spread their hate through aggressive youth subcultures, the subcultures fight back and share the news through their DIY and self-published zine culture of this pre-internet period, including, notably, through magazines like Maximum Rock and Roll. Meanwhile, the Christian right is intensifying their war on abortion clinics and doctors and queer folks. Remind anyone of anything? Across the country. Okay, so enough monologue for me. I think you get the drift, and I really do suggest that you check out the podcast and the book that's linked in the show notes as well. At this time, I'll give you a little intros to the interview's two guests. Mike Crenshaw was born and raised in Chicago and Minneapolis and currently resides in Portland, Oregon. Crenshaw is an independent hip-hop artist, respected MC, poet, educator, and activist. Crenshaw is the leading U.S. organizer of the African hip-hop caravan and uses cultural activism as a means to develop international solidarity related to human rights and justice through hip-hop and popular education. Mike is also a founding member of the Minneapolis Baldies and Anti-Racist Action. He was a co-producer and narrator of the podcast version of It Did Happen Here. Mo Baustern is an alum of the anarchist spaces in Chicago known as A-Zone, which lasted from 1993 to 2003. She's also a writer and laborer, Fisher poet, and DIY social practice artist. Mo is a longtime editor of many publications, including the commercial fishing zine Extra Tough, and she was a writer on the podcast version of It Did Happen Here and lives in Portland, Oregon as well. For the hour, we talk about the book, the podcast, the reach of this project, the resonance to anti-racist struggle today in Portland and beyond. We also talk about the toll of the violence faced by and engaged by folks pushing back the organized white supremacy of the day, police and institutional violence, and other related topics. If you'd like the people featured in this book to come and speak at your institution, you can reach out to them at itdidhappenherepodcast@gmail.com or through PM Press or via the It Did Happen Here Instagram. The book was published by PM Press as a part of the Working Class History series. Another featured title in that series that was recently released was a similar documentary history with a really good narrative on the history of anti-racist action in the 1990s and early 2000s throughout the Midwest of Turtle Island, both in so-called Canada and the USA, and bits of other areas of those countries. Hopefully, we'll feature a chat with one of the contributors to that book entitled We Go Where They Go, The Story of Anti-Racist Action, pretty soon on this show. Enjoy. And be sure to check the show notes for links to social media, as well as other interesting articles, documentaries, and other things related to this story. There's a lot there. And if you're listening to the radio edition of this and want to find a little more of this interview plus Sean Swain's segment, consider subscribing to our podcast feed or finding us on online streaming platforms, which are listed and linked at tfsr.wtf.
My name is Mike Crenshaw. I'm he, him pronouns. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I've been here about 30 years. I'm from Chicago and Minneapolis.
My name is Mo Baustern, she, her pronouns. I've been living in Portland. I started moving here in 96, and I came from Chicago where I'd been for about 11 years, but I grew up in Western New York.
Thanks a lot, both of you, for taking the time to have this conversation. And thanks for these amazing two projects that we're going to be talking about right now. Yeah, I wonder if you'd be willing to talk like briefly about the story of the podcast, which was the precursor to the book that we're going to be talking about, and sort of how you were brought into it.
There's a lot of different aspects of people, places, time in history that have converged in order for me to be part of this podcast, one of the co-producers and an editor of the book, and also one of the narrators, along with Selena Flores, and you know, Aaron did some narration as well, even though the majority of it was Selena and I was managing KBOO Community Radio, a community radio station here in Portland. I'm from Chicago. I lived in Minneapolis in my teenage years, where I was a founding member of the Minneapolis Baldies and Anti-Racist Action and the Syndicate. These are various formations that came out of the anti-racist skinhead movement. I moved from Minneapolis to Portland in 1990 for an extended period, a brief, you know, probably about almost a year I was here, because my mom had left Minneapolis for Portland with my little sister when she divorced my sister's dad. So I knew I had a place to visit. I came and visited. I liked it. Went back home to Minneapolis, and then in 92 I returned to Portland, and I've been here ever since. When I came here in 90, it was 2 years after the murder of Mulugeta Seraw. I was actually interested in getting out. I was coming to Portland because I was interested in maybe leaving Minneapolis because of the toll that my lifestyle had taken on me as a young man. I was I had a lot of PTSD from violence, dealing with pretty heavy, you know, alcohol and drug abuse, and I just wanted to change. When I came to Portland in 1990 to visit my mom, I knew that I had an extended family to welcome me in the anti-racist skinhead scene. And that's because Portland had a terrible history with white supremacist skinheads and white power gangs, and we had heard about it back in Minneapolis. Prior to me coming here, you know, some anti-racist skinheads had reached out to other cities for support in their fight against the Nazis. And some people from our network in Anti-Racist Action responded. So prior to me even arriving in Portland, some of my best friends from Chicago and Minneapolis that were anti-racist skinheads and also part of the ARA network had come to Portland and helped the Portland anti-racist skinheads confront some of the Nazis that were so problematic out here. So I have a very personal relationship to the story that we tell in the podcast, in that I was part of this movement that really took hold in Minneapolis and Chicago, but played a very supportive role of what wound up happening here in Portland, and then actually moved to Portland. Many, many years later, I wound up managing KBOO and I met Aaron Yankee. And Aaron and I, you know, we were close at KBOO. We were friends and coworkers. And Aaron heard the story of me being an anti-racist black skinhead, encouraged me to, well, she knew that I was working on my own book, which I still haven't finished, that PM Press is also gonna publish. And she asked me when the book was gonna be done. And I was like, I don't know, I'm really slow with my book. But I think in an effort to get it done, I'm going to actually go home and interview some of the people that I grew up with. The tentative title of my book is Black Skinhead, and I was going to tell the story of being a black anti-racist skinhead in Minneapolis Baldy. So I went back to Minneapolis and Chicago to interview people, and Aaron was like, what do you think about using some of those interviews for this story that I want to tell through a podcast about what happened here in Portland? So I know I feel like I'm being really long-winded, so I hope it's not too confusing for folks, but Aaron approached me and said, would you share some of the interviews that you're going to use for your book in this effort to tell the story of the history of anti-racist and anti-fascist organizing here in Portland? And I said, sure, you know, and that kind of blending the content that I was initially going to have solely for my book into the podcast created this collaborative project where now I was collaborating with Aaron and Selena. And that's when Aaron let me know that, you know, Mo and Julie and Icky were all willing to support the production of the podcast. And so for about a year and a half, I helped gather a lot of the people that we wound up interviewing from Chicago, Minneapolis specifically. And the podcast came together, and then PM Press was like, hey, what do y'all think about putting out the book? So
yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. I really enjoyed the podcast when it came out. It hit me from the side because I'd heard little bits of this history before, but I think the way that bringing in the voices of people in their actual stories into this like scripted narrative structure and contextualizing it, plus all the soundtrack to it, just all of it really blended together, made these really easy, like relatively short episodes that kept me waiting for the next one. Good on y'all. And it seems so perfect. Like when I cracked open the book version of this, one of the first interviews in there, I forget which one it is off the top of my head, but I was reading it and I was like, I know this story. Like I've heard these words before. Getting to hear that voice in my head then, and getting to have an expansion of that story with more detail that didn't make it into the podcast, whether because of, you know, KBOO's rules or because of just the format being different, was amazing, especially alongside all of the graphics that you all included in there, all the flyers, all the photographs. It just really fleshed out some of this experience that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Burris. One of the things that I'm really enjoying is hearing about the impact that the podcast has had on people. I don't think I'll ever get tired of it because there are similarities between the types of things that folks point out, but you know, being that we're individuals, we have this really subjective experience. And so each person's experience, even though there are all these commonalities, is a little bit different. So when I hear about how different people remember that time and how they get to recall and relive things through listening to the podcast, it's just, I guess one of the biggest benefits of that for me is that I really sense the power of the collective, first in the team that created the podcast, because I couldn't have done this by myself, you know, but it was everybody's skills coalescing that made it the powerful, you know, thing that it is. And then to understand that this is a national story. There are people all over this country who have some skin in the game or something that was impactful about that time in their life, if they're old enough, right? So yeah, I really enjoy that. It's profound.
And I think besides the people that were involved at the time and those relationships that you have, it's also a multi-generational story. I mean, obviously, like the time when this came out at the start of the pandemic, Portland had already been suffering a wave that had lasted a few years of groups like Patriot Front and the Proud Boys and other neo-fascist formations taking space, fighting people in the streets, attacking people. And so that was one reason that I thought it was so powerful, was to hear this, like, not only like a resonance from struggle in the past, but an opportunity for people like who are organizing now to hear the voices and the experiences of the people like in back in the day and who are still here and still struggling in the same, like maybe in a different way. In some cases, people have retired from street combat and they're writing or they're researching or they're doing audio work or writing books. But I wonder if what kind of feedback y'all have gotten in that way. Like I know the podcast stream has a few public events where you took some Q&As and stuff like that, but what kind of impact have you measured from the podcast in that way?
Well, we had a really sweet event in the park. I can't remember what the group was called. It was a Portland history. It was like the People's History of Portland, sort of People's History Project. And it was young people who were inviting different groups to just tell stories from Portland history. And they invited us and set up mics and stuff for us. And we had a couple guests come. We had Tom T came, who was a Portland Baldy was, I think he was an ARA member, I think, also. Who else came, or was it just Tom was the guest? And all of us were there. Icky was in the audience, and the rest of us were on a panel. And this was in April, and I definitely remember when episodes were dropping of, getting feedback from people who were spending their nights in the streets, you know, down at the wall, down at the fence or whatever, and then I had one person who would be texting me about the response from their little crew that they called the homies, and it was really awesome to just feel that wave kind of sloshing back and forth, like we were putting this stuff out and then it just coming back to us, and we were able to feel that definitely at that event, and there were hundreds of people there. It was really cool, and it was a listening event. Like, we listened to episode 2, which is the murder of Mulugeta Sarah, and then there was a little bit of a Q&A. It was pretty powerful. It was great. And I agree. I like the way, Mike, the way you put it, where you're just like, I don't think I'm going to get tired of hearing about the podcast. I mean, the one thing that is hard about it, I think, is just like, in the 2 years that people had in the pandemic, you know, like, everybody has a podcast. And so it's just like, you just kind of say like, yeah, I did this podcast. And they're like, oh yeah, right. And I have to, and I kind of want to be like, no, you don't understand. This podcast is like a sledgehammer.
Well, that's, to me, one of the more important things about this podcast is that there's a captive audience that finds their way to the podcast through word of mouth, through social networks. And the people who need to hear it are hearing it. But it's not because I'm spending 45 minutes on social media 5 days a week to promote it. I think capitalism demands this promotional aspect. And yeah, we are doing promotional work. And as a team, it's a lot easier and more effective than if we were trying to do it as individuals. But the thing about the podcast is it's relevant. It's looking at issues that are central to this society, the foundation of this country, and how those issues manifest and impact our lives daily. And I don't care what generation you're from, if you're alive and breathing, and many people aren't here anymore, there's part of this story that, whether you're aware of it or not, it matters. You know, when we look at racial justice, when we look at capitalism, when we look at systems of oppression, all these different aspects of the reality that define our reality intersect through these personal stories. And the confrontation that is at the center of the podcast is a life and death confrontation. And from that life and death confrontation based on community defense and violent racial terror, ideological orientation and political consciousness emerges. When we started fighting Nazis in the streets as teenagers, we didn't think of ourselves as activists. We didn't know what an activist was. We grew into the role of being politically conscious and oriented to social justice activism only because we were compelled to do what we felt was right. And it was at that time that older people in the community who identified as peace activists or anti-war activists or feminists or anarchists, they were drawn to what we were doing organically. And that was when we began to get the political education. Like, oh, what? You mean people were actually doing this before we did it? Oh, we're part of a continuum. People have historically stood up against exactly what we're standing up against now. And the story we tell is centered around the 80s and the 90s in this country, but fascism has continued to threaten all of our existence. And so that's why it's still relevant. When I remember when the Obama run for president was when we first started to see a certain kind of backlash and a move to the right, because he was a non-white person who looked like he was going to win the presidential election. That is happening in the context of brutal late stage capitalist gutting of the social safety net that's been going on in this country for decades. So vanishing entitlement, fear and xenophobia, and white folks going, we can't lose the privilege that we have. And that's what's at the center of all the fear mongering that ever happens in this country, is the threat to white privilege that shifting realities represent. So going from Obama into Trump, we continue to see this push to the right, and these paramilitary organizations, these confrontational fascist bastards showing up in the cities, and it happened a lot here. Portland was a hotbed for that. Like you said, Patriot Prayer. I remember seeing these guys yelling. I'm like, these motherfuckers are trying to get hit. They're so far right. People who are typically celebrated by the right, military veterans, they would go up to people who somehow, you know, were signifying that they were combat veterans or military veterans in the public and of recent wars, foreign wars, and they would confront them and scream the most disrespectful shit at these people because they were trying to start a fight. And so I remember that was the first thing I noticed, and that was during the Obama years. I'm like, there are people out here who are so determined to instigate a situation that will escalate into violence, that if this shit catches on, the streets are going to be really dangerous. And sure enough, Trump comes in and there's a proliferation with the Proud Boys and the Boogaloos and all these different people. So what starts to happen is that these people are becoming emboldened by Trump's message and rhetoric. They're violent, they're confrontational, and they're starting to be supported. They're starting to find support in a political base of people who are sympathetic with their fear-mongering. And so once again, we start to see when they come to protest and demonstrate and counter-demonstrate that they're being protected by the police. Now they're carrying arms. And that's the context in which any of the demonstration culture around the movement for Black Lives, anything that was around the rights of queer people, anything that was around reproductive rights, these guys are targeting the people who are in the streets demanding social justice, and they're violently confronting people. So then now we're starting to understand, like, oh, the fascist threat that we faced in the 80s and 90s is on steroids. And, you know, we could go on. You know, we have an environment now where activists are being murdered and getting away with murder. And, you know, anti-racist, anti-fascist, you know, pro-reproductive rights activists, people who are standing for the rights of trans people and queer people are being hunted down and murdered. And the people who are killing them are getting away with murder and are being celebrated as heroes. So I think the point I'm trying to make is that what we're talking about in the podcast has only become more relevant every month, because people are desperate to understand, like, what can we do? What was effective? And what's the way forward?
And the thing that I always notice about the story as the podcast tells it, and as Mike lived it and his experience of it, and the people that were involved, like John Baer and Michael Clark and Tom T, and the stories that they tell, Peter Little, is noticing how young these guys were. You know, a lot of those stories that you read about in the book or you hear about on the podcast, these kids are like, I was 15, I was 16, I got thrown out of my house, I wasn't living at home. And so these were all young, not all, but a lot of the kids who ended up as Sharps or with ARA were young men. And they had already had some sort of disruption in the home that got them out and finding each other and creating a loving brotherhood together where they had each other and they had each other's backs. I mean, Mike always points this out when you look at the photographs in the book, these are personal photographs that Coyote Amrich let us use that have never really been published. And you can just see the light in the eyes of the people, of the subjects of the photos, because they're looking at people they love. Coyote, you know, that was relationships that existed between folks. It wasn't just taking pictures of skinheads on the street. It was friends. You see the picture of John Bear on chapter 9, and his face is just open. And when we opened the book at the, we had a little party for the people who participated in the book, and just like opening to that page, and I could just feel the wave of emotion coming off of, I think it was Jonathan Mazzocchi when he looked at that image, and he was just like, oh my God, look at him. My point being, those kids also exist today. There are plenty of people who are, you know, whatever you want to call people, like, who can't put up with the fascism in the home, who had to move out for whatever reason, especially with this attack on trans kids and on immigrants and on anybody who isn't falling in line with the fascist understanding of personhood. And I don't, like, there isn't a way to connect with people. The trust between generations is just decimated. In my experience, you know, when I was, you asked about my experience in Chicago, and I mean, I made my way towards the anarchists. I was working with the Women's Action Coalition, which was a short-lived group of women who would, you know, in the spirit of ACT UP. ACT UP, we really influenced a lot of the activism that was happening in Chicago in the early 90s. And also through the story, you know, Scott Nakagawa was a member of ACT UP. So the model that they were giving us was a big public, artistic, creative confrontation with media. And that, you know, had been happening in the past. You know, the Yippies had done stuff like that too, but doing it on a much more confrontational scale. And at the time, Operation Rescue had come to Chicago and was curtailing abortion rights, chaining themselves to clinics and really starting very aggressive attacks on women's rights. They would go on to kill Dr. Gunn, a man who performed abortions, just murdered him. And so there was a lot of turnout, and that's kind of where I got involved with the Women's Action Coalition. And then at one of the demonstrations, I met a bunch of kids who were way more my speed, and they all had colored hair, like, which at the time was very unusual, and like different, you know, manic panic hair, and they were just hilarious and fun. And I ended up going home with them. And that was the end of me and the Women's Action Coalition. And I just started hanging out with the anarchists. And one of the things that we would do was walk around at night with cans of spray paint and hunt down Nazi graffiti, which we were living in around Wicker Park at the time. And it was up. It was up. You know, you could just, and people would let us know throughout the day. And one person would kind of create a little bit of a map, and then we'd all go out at night and within crews of two or three people and hit it and cover it up and stuff. And I remember when ARA started, like maybe 92 or 91, when people in Chicago started getting involved in ARA. And at the time, I was fishing 4 months a year and then 6 months a year on boats up in Alaska. And I was usually the only woman on the boat. And one of the things about the anti-racist action, it was just like a level of like very male, you know, dominated and intense, a level of intensity that I already lived in for 4 months of the year. So I can remember just being like, I love you guys from over here. I'm just going to keep working on the women's stuff on these months when I'm not, you know, up to my eyeballs and people, you know, like basically dudes telling me how to do things all the time. So, you know, I look back and I'm just like, that's kind of, but there were people around me that were doing that, and we were participating in terms of just like occasional tabling and running the A zone and just connecting people. Like, we just held a space for people to come in and do stuff, and, you know, smaller organizing like that. And it was really Sprite, who was on a much more national level. He was very connected with prisoner support and ARA stuff. And he did it for years. And I remember visiting Chicago in the early aughts, and he just was like, Mo, I'm still doing it. I'm still tracking down all these white supremacists. And he would find them on the internet and then go out to their houses and knock on the door. And he said that more often than not at that time, which is now over 20 years ago, it was a lot of times it was like 14-year-old kids at their computers by themselves in the basement, which brings me back to like the beginning of this point, which was that there's a way in which the left continually attacks itself. And I know we've all seen it, and it has lots of different forms. And even just speaking about like what I was involved in the 90s, I have this feeling of guilt that I wasn't part of ARA, because we were all supposed to be everything, you know, instead of just like, I'm doing this and I have solidarity with you and I have, you know, love and support for you. And the right is really good at recruiting. It's really good at bringing people in, although, you know, they fight each other and it's gross and stuff. But I see the book and the podcast as a real opportunity to really place everyone in the continuum, like Mike said. And we're older, you know, a lot of us are in our 50s, but we're at least still alive and we're vital enough to be able to, like, hopefully connect with people. And a dream that I have for, and I think I share this with other members of the team that I don't want to speak for, but the events that the potential events that we can have around the book is just like to call these people who share this history in their towns from that time. Because as we state in the book and the podcast, if you looked at Maximum Rock and Roll at the time, there was, everybody had skinhead problems, white supremacist skinhead problems all over the country. And you just maybe felt like it was just you in your town because it was just happening. So I think there's a real opportunity to show up, do an event with local people and have a place to be connect, you know, like have a place to connect. Even if you just connect with a couple of people and connect the streams, instead of being everybody being in like a little pond of their own history, to just really break the dams and let it flow.
I wanted to sort of explore a little bit more about the importance of talking about the sort of traumas that people get from doing the sorts of work, whether it be defending reproductive rights, whether it be fighting and like hunting or even infiltrating like far right groups, what have you, and sort of the way that trauma is expressed in the book, which I think is pretty interesting. It's a thing that I think people are getting better about talking about now. But, or the other question that I was thinking of approaching would be like, to sort of like drop in and ask about the sort of end of the book where the SPLC comes in and sues the Metzgers, and then you see like sort of a collapse of the ways that anti-racist organizing happened in Portland. Do either of those like sound especially interesting to discuss? I can like ask the question.
And I do want to just say that like, as somebody, you know, I looked into a lot of that, the history regarding the second question, and in talking to Jonathan Mazzocchi and things that didn't make it into the book or the podcast, I just want to say like homophobia actually also had a real impact on the collapse of like organizing at a particular level, because they were so committed, the CHD and the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment were committed to the Big Tent organizing and supporting gay rights. And then when they were bringing different groups in, like churches would be like, well, we don't want to pay into your organization anymore because we don't think gay people should exist. And that was really because of the rise of the, oh God, what was the name of that organization?
The Oregon Citizens.
Oregon Citizens Alliance, OCA.
OCA.
So I just want to stick that in there. It wasn't just the Metzger trial. The Metzger trial happened in 92. And the Northwest Coalition for Malicious Harassment, which kind of marked the end and the collapse, was in like 98 or 97.
There, Mo reminded me that there's not any singular kind of thread at work at any one time. No single aspect of the evolution and how things evolved and shifted was happening in a vacuum. There are multiple factors. And, you know, we have to look at the fact that Coalition for Human Dignity represented a different demographic than, say, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice or the Minneapolis Baldies or even ARA. What made ARA effective was that ARA was able to build alliances with Coalition for Human Dignity and other demographic groups. And it was that coalition work that made it not safe for people to be as brazenly right-wing and fascist as they had grown comfortable being, right? But if we want to look at the most militant arm of all this work was the anti-racist skinhead scene. And in the anti-racist skinhead scene, you had predominantly teenagers who are growing through adolescence into young adulthood, some of whom are starting to have kids, some of whom are starting to have more serious relationship to jobs and trying to have stable housing. And so as the violence becomes more criminalized by the state, people start to shift their priorities. So that's one thing that started to happen in what started as a teenage movement, right? Another thing that started to happen was that because of the effectiveness of the movement, a lot of the Nazis and people who were brazenly and outwardly and publicly fascist started to go underground. And they started to shift the way that they showed up. And their organizing, in a lot of cases, went more into less public places, onto the internet, and people began to change the way that they looked and their fashion aesthetic because they didn't want to be identified publicly anymore. And they didn't want to be doxxed and they didn't want to be attacked when they were in the streets. And then in addition to that, I'll just say that those were things that were intersecting in conversion, is that, you know, people were getting older, Nazis were going more underground, and I think some people were withdrawing more into themselves. I think in Portland specifically, the skinhead network grew tired of feeling like they were being used as bodyguards and shock troops or stormtroopers for the left. And they felt like they weren't being respected as much as they wanted to be, and that they were always asked to do security. People knew that they were willing to engage in violence, but then people weren't necessarily valuing their consciousness or therefore, you know, humanity.
It seemed like there was a way in which that violence was, you know, people wanted to use the violence when it served them. And then when it didn't, those kids are really harshly criticized and socially, you know, punished for being the thing they were asked to be. And especially, you know, when Mike is saying they're teenagers. And they're just, we didn't have a really great understanding that we have now. We have such a greater understanding of mental health and just being the spectrum that people can exist on and neurodivergence. I just think a lot about identifying with that.
And again, you know, to look at the confrontational aspect of the most militant part of this movement, if we were to have two poles in Portland, where one was East Side White Pride and White Aryan Resistance and American Front and the neo-Nazi groups that, you know, wound up taking Mulugeta Sarraw's life. And then on the other end, you know, we have the anti-racist formation that had various names, from Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice with Sharp to a Portland chapter of the Baldies. We could, if we wanted to oversimplify things, we could bookend things and we could look at the murder of Mulugeta Sarraw on one end by the Nazis. And then we could look at the death of Eric Banks, who was a neo-Nazi who was killed by John Bear. And we have to understand that when John Bear killed Eric Banks, that there were some pretty heavy reverberations in the scene, because the response from the state was, we're going to do what we have to do to put some people behind bars. So that probably had a chilling effect on people who were in that circle that John Bear was from, because people had to either figure out how to not be implicated, how to keep their mouth shut, how to lay low, how to keep their freedom, or be ready to do some time because the police were looking to find out who they could put away, right? On the other side, you probably had some Nazis who were like, I don't want to get shot. This is escalating and people are going to die. So, you know, for as macho as the male dominated aspect of the movement that was willing to use violence might look from the outside, you know, people are still human. And when people die, it impacts people. When people go to prison, people go, you know, maybe I'm going to think a little bit more seriously about the consequences of what we're doing and start to ask these questions. Like, are there more effective ways to hold on to my values and to contribute to the struggle that don't involve me losing my life or that don't involve me going to prison for a long time?
I appreciate the fact that you made space for in the history for talking about the difficulties of living hard lives among the youth subcultures who were fighting racists, the violence and substance abuse, the undermining by authority figures, the prison sentences like Tom T. and John Bear that came out both in the book and the podcast. And I was wondering if you got much response on making space for those hard and inward looking portions of the podcast. I know the book just came out, so maybe not so much reflection on that yet.
Yeah, I think there were two bonus episodes, and there was one that I was particularly pleased with. Having had the majority of the podcast done, I was able to look back and reflect on some of the points that were kind of sticking with me overall. And it was this question, you know, Aaron phrases it nicely, this question of, what is it that motivates us to risk our own safety to make the community safe for not just ourselves, but others? And, you know, that's the principle that underlies this concept of community defense. But it takes a toll. The trauma takes a toll. And I think there's a lot of lessons in that. Like, trauma is something that feels bad and it has a very negative connotation because people get hurt and people die and people are sad and people are impacted in really long lasting ways that are not easy. However, there's if you're present with the teaching that's available, there are some really valuable things about who we are. And to risk your safety to protect yourself, to risk your own personal safety to protect others, forces you to confront your own limitations in a way that you wind up sitting with something really authentic about yourself that you might not have discovered otherwise. And there's some truth in there that I think is deeper than rhetoric and ideological slogans and phrases. And I think what we see, I've always trusted people who have been through violence to keep peace better than people who say that they're nonviolent but have never actually endured violence. Because I think people who've lost something because of the trauma of violence have a bit more stake into not losing those things and not wanting to see other people have to lose those things. I think that there's something about a principle of unconditional love that underlies this work when we take a stand against things that are a threat to all of us. And if we could look at it as a polemic, and even though we know it's more complex than that, we can understand that the fascists, their movement and their ideology is based on fear of extermination, fear of annihilation, and the insecurity that underlies that. And so their justification for violence is based on the fear of being annihilated. We're trying to keep people safe. They're trying to destroy the ability for people to exist. And that's what we have to understand. I think there's a lot of history that we can look at that we could define as anti-fascist, but there's a lot of rhetoric and propaganda about what Antifa means. And I think that's an important conversation we have to continue to have, even though it's tired. And one of the reasons that it's tired is because there's this oversaturation of scapegoating and criminalizing of people who say that they're anti-fascist. And it's the mainstream media has been so effective at influencing the way people think, that when people think of Antifa, they think of people who are basically just assholes who want to make everybody uncomfortable and who are so self-righteous and arrogant about their political orientation that they're intolerant. The reality of it is the people who were committing to this level of sacrifice were people who just wanted the community to be safe, and people who wanted to point out that the people who were the most dangerous were a threat to all of us.
Coming to Portland in 96 from Chicago, I was going to demonstrations all the time in Chicago in various ways, and I was shocked at the way the police treated people at the protests here. It was so much more personal. It was so much more pointed. It was so much more dangerous to go to a protest in Portland when I started coming here and hanging out. And that was shocking because everything else about Portland was so small and easy. Like, I never felt like my life was, you know, I just could go anywhere at any time by myself in Portland and never feel like I was going to get jumped or there was any danger on the streets. But then you go to a protest and you're just like, everybody was like, never leave alone, always leave immediately. If you're the last ones at the protest, that's when you get. And it was just like over and over seeing that and watching the cops break people's arms and the cops try and ride. They had the horses and they would always try and ride people over. And then there was literally documents that stated that, you know, one of the tactics of the anarchist women was to throw themselves underneath the horses as a way to scare the police, you know. So I just, like, it was something I had never seen before. And, you know, you come from a big city like Chicago and you just think you know everything about, well, maybe that's just my nature. It's just like, oh, yeah, well, Chicago, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no way, man, this Portland stuff is something different.
It's not like the police in Chicago are known for having, like, a soft touch or whatever.
No,
I mean, those f***ers would just hit you over the head, but they didn't care. I mean, in Portland, it was personal. They were vindictive.
What you're describing is something that I've been tracking, and not to say that I've been tracking it as if I'm the only person who's been paying attention, but I don't hear a lot of people talk about this. You know, Portland, and to a large degree, the Pacific Northwest, settled by white settlers in a very systematically and systemically exclusive way. Mm-hmm. Violent exclusion of non-white people, genocidal frontier push in terms of Native Americans, that happened everywhere on this landmass. But there was something about the Western settler project and Oregon specifically that was very intentionally about, this is for white men and white men only. And whatever you guys are doing back in the East and down South and in the Midwest, we're gonna fight and keep this shit white. So white power has always been personal here because it has its origin in, if you're gonna keep this land and you're going to hold on to this privilege that you have, you're going to defend it by force. White people who don't toe the line are a problem. White people who are anti-racist, white people who are race traitors, white people who will prioritize the rights of others over the rights of white people to dominate have to be dealt with harshly. And I think we see that in the way that the anti-authoritarian white left is dealt with by the state here. We saw it with the WTO. We saw it with the environmental justice movement. We see it with the anarchists. We see it with Antifa. We see it with Black Lives Matter. Because there's a power structure that is not going to tolerate its own children undermining it. And that's what I see when I see that personal violence that the police are exacting on protesters. That's what I'm seeing. When they hunted down Mike Renault and shot him in Olympia, that's what I'm seeing. When Kyle Rittenhouse gets away with murder all the way over in Wisconsin, that's what we're seeing. When June Knightley, aka T-Rex, is killed by a mass shooter at a park in Portland at a Black Lives Matter protest, that man hunted down a group of women and shot five people, and they talk about him like a homeowner.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? They prioritize the fact his relationship to private property, right, is more important than the fact that he attacked a group of people who were there to keep people safe and killed one of them. So we see these things time and time again, and I think that there's something about that. I don't want to center whiteness, because this is ultimately, this is about liberation for the most oppressed people. We have to understand the way that radical white people are treated in this project is a direct correlation to the fact that they're undermining white power.
Mo, I didn't know if you wanted to.
I just want to be like, woo, that's what white does. So good. And yeah, totally experienced it. Totally outsized violent reaction. And the Oregonian newspaper has been on board with it the whole way. And all the big media outlets for sure. I mean, it's just like the propaganda that is, and propaganda is very effective. I mean, you just wave in front of people's faces, and then the next day they're saying like, oh yeah, Antifa's gonna come and destroy your house. They're gonna take your home. So you better just get a gun. I mean, whatever. People can have guns if they want it. You know, it's a hot topic right now. But I'm just like, and you wanted us to opine about forms of anti-racist organizing at this time. I'm hoping to learn more about it. I have to say, you know, I've been dealing with disability and cancer and the pandemic and stuff, so I have had to like really step back. So I mean, if anybody comes to one of our events, I'm super into finding out, like, and supporting what the organizing is. And I am hoping to move into an older age. Like, I'm in my 50s, and I would love to grow into a venerable, pissed off crone that can continue to connect with young people. I mean, I love, you know, like, I have lots of friendships with young people, and the book and the podcast both are really great for it. It was so fun to just be able to sort of vent some of my thoughts about materialism and white supremacy and capitalism and classism and just like the relentless attack on working people, especially working people who are not white, as Mike says, you know, like, yeah, the oligarchy. I'm ready to connect with people, you know, and I mean, the book really gives me a lot of hope to weave threads that have always been there, but they're just hard to pick up. Like, everybody is so hurt, I feel like. I mean, I developed PTSD after, really impacted at the WTO, and then, well, really, you know, having a violent upbringing, but then not really believing in that until like the WTO after that, and then trying to function in Portland in demonstrations, and just, you know, really would love to be able to be a part of supporting, helping people learn how to support each other when there's conflict in leftist communities, so that we can continue to provide each other with the unconditional love that, and tap into it, so that we can remain comrades and not have to drop out in order to be okay.
Can I add to that, Mo?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, and I think the two things that are exciting is that the book, you know, the book is out. The podcast is out and the book is out. The podcast is going to continue to reach people that haven't heard it yet. The book is going to reach people who don't really listen to podcasts. The book has the ability to be relevant. When you pair them together, we were contacted by the Oregon Historical Society, and we were contracted to write a high school curriculum for the book and the podcast. So this information is going to be in classrooms. Teachers are going to be teaching grades 9 through 12. And I think that that's one of the more exciting outcomes because a younger generation gets to live and process in their own time this story, this history. And Minnesota Historical Society is bringing out John Bear and myself and a number of people from Minneapolis to do a screening of the Baldies documentary that was produced in the same time period that the podcast was catching on to the audience. And so I think that there's an institutional interest in supporting the work, and that the work is going to be able to reach places that we wouldn't have thought of. And that's exciting because it's going to matter to people.
If folks do want to, I mean, obviously they can pick up the book, you know, in all sorts of different places. If they want, if they have the resources to be able to invite y'all or some of the other folks from the book of the podcast into their spaces, where do they reach out? Through PM, or do you have a separate website?
Yeah, they could reach out through PM. Oh, what's that? It did happen here.
podcast@gmail.com. It did happen here, podcast@gmail.com.
And follow It Did Happen Here on Instagram.
Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome.
And you can DM through the Instagram account also.
Correct.
Cool. Thank you again. Thank you both so much for having this conversation. This is The Final Straw Radio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions and suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills,